Our next topic is business succession planning, and probably the most important of those topics is buy-sell planning, because this is the most frequent way to transfer a business interest from one party to another. Usually when you're looking at small businesses, this is what they automatically think of. They don't jump to things like opportunity shifting or earnouts or anything like that. They always think about how can they sell their interest and capitalize on the value that they've generated over time. So this is we'll spend the rest of today and part of tomorrow going over buy-sell agreements, and I'll talk a little bit more about some other business succession planning techniques and applications. And then then on Thursday we'll start asset protection planning. So that's where our agenda is. Now, buy-sell agreement's nothing magic. It's just an agreement that says one party agrees to buy and one party agrees to sell the business interest. Creates a legal obligation for both parties. Now, this can be important when we're trying to do things like generate liquidity for the estate, but if we don't have a legal obligation, there's no guarantee that the person's going to be able to capitalize or get the money for their interest when they need it. The two most common triggers for buy-sells are going to be death and disability. And the reason why those are the two most common triggers is those are things we can insure. We can buy disability buy-sell insurance, and we can buy life insurance to trigger or to create the lump sum of cash we need to buy out the business interest. So those are standard, kind of almost standard provisions in a buy-sell agreement, but there are lots of other circumstances where you might trigger the buy-sell. And some of those other circumstances could include things like marriage, divorce, a competition clause. They're all kind of, these things can be custom tailored to do what you want to do. But if you have other types of triggering events, you're going to have some other kind of funding mechanism. You can't buy an insurance policy to hedge against the risk of divorce, for example, right? That's a little hard to do. So, especially with the incidence of divorce, nobody would insure it these days because there's a certainty that you're going to have to pay out on it. But those two we can get insurance for. And I'll put these slides up, by the way, so you don't have to copy everything. I'll make these available for you. Now, the advantages, first of all, provide liquidity for the estate. One of the problems we have with estate planning, with business owners, usually the biggest asset in the estate of a business owner is the business itself, and it's usually not a small amount. And it's kind of funny in this area because you talk to some business owners and they have a little business and they think it's worth a fortune, right? They just have these illusions of grandeur, how valuable this thing is when it really probably isn't. But then you talk to this other business owner who's been running the business for 30 or 40 years and maybe inherited it from dad and has no clue what the business is worth, thinks it's worth maybe a year's worth of earnings or something like that, when in reality it's worth a heck of a lot more than that. So when we talk about this type of planning, we need to have good appraisals. We need to know what the thing is worth before we engage in this process, because that's going to tell us how much we're going to need to pay for estate taxes, and that's going to tell us what we should include in the buy-sell agreement itself and how much insurance we should buy. So this all ties together and it centers around that valuation. The valuation is all important. It does create a market for the stock. That's one of the problems we have with closely held family businesses. There's no market we can go to dump the stock when we want to. And unless you create a market for the stock, you're probably going to have problems selling it. Because if, let's say that I die today and I have a minority interest in the Langdon partnership, how many of you are going to want to buy that interest from my estate? None of you are going to want to buy it from my estate because you can't control it. You can't force distributions. You can't control the policy of the company. You can't make dividends be issued or distributions be made. You can't do any of that. So you're not going to want to buy that interest. So we need to create some kind of market for the stock. There, I mentioned when we were talking about some of the retirement planning options, ESOPs, employee stock option plans. Those are our ownership plan, employee stock ownership plans. Those are great tools to create markets for stock as well. And when you have a business owner who doesn't necessarily have a natural successor in their family, but has several people in the business that could take over, but can't afford to take over, an ESOP is almost a perfect solution for them, because they can sell part of their stock to the ESOP. What they receive won't be taxable to them if they buy a portfolio of marketable securities. So they can basically diversify their portfolio by setting up the ESOP, transfer part of the ownership interest to the employees, and now when it comes time to transition the company to the key employees, now you only have to sell a portion of the shares instead of the whole company. So it's a great way of thinking about this, creating market for the stock and doing business succession planning. But barring that, we have the buy-sell agreement. The fire sale issue. This is important as well. It kind of ties to the estate planning issues. But if I die today and I have that business interest in my estate, and that's the primary thing I have in my estate, and I have an estate tax that's worth or that is going to be higher than the value of all my other assets, and you know this is the case, are you going to pay me or pay my estate fair market value for my business interest? No, because I need cash. So you're going to take advantage of that circumstance and you're going to discount it. So a lot of times when you see these fire sales through estates, the family gets cheated out of value that was created by the business owner because there was no planning to transition that interest. If you have an adequately prepared buy-sell agreement, you can avoid that. Fix the value for tax purposes. This is tricky these days. When we started talking about the trust, remember I gave you four code sections that we would address, sections 2701 through 2704. We did 2702 when we talked about the Gratz and the Gratz and the Cuperts and the tangible personal property trust. In this section, we're going to talk about section 2703, which deals with valuation restrictions on buy-sell agreements. Since 1990, these are the rules we have to follow on the buy-sells. And if you don't follow these rules very, very tightly, you will not get to fix the value of the business in the agreement. So bottom line is you have to be careful about how those things are structured. And then maintain control. I've never met a family or closely held business owner that's not a control freak. That they're absolutely paranoid about anybody else coming in and exerting any influence over the operations of that business. So having the buy-sell lets us keep the business interest among those people that we want to have in control and lets us keep the outsiders out. Now, there are three primary types of agreements. We have cross-purchase agreements, entity agreements, and then these hybrid agreements. The cross-purchase agreements are the ones that are usually the most effective from a tax standpoint, but they can also be the most complex from an administrative standpoint. So there's a trade-off here. Do you want the tax savings or do you want simplicity? The entity buy-sell agreements are the ones where we have the entity itself purchase the shares or the interest from the deceased owner or disabled owner. Those are a little bit simpler in their administration, but we don't get as good a tax benefit when we use an entity agreement. And a hybrid agreement is one that is going to take advantage of both types. And usually a hybrid agreement is tied into a planning technique that we have available under section 303 of the code, which deals with the redemption of corporate shares at death. And I'll talk about the tax consequences of this when we get to that section. But basically, if we can do a corporate redemption at death, we want to, because that'll strip out earnings and profits from a corporation without triggering dividend tax treatment. Major benefit. Because it takes what would be taxable, tainted money inside the corporation, that when it's distributed will be taxable to the owners, and makes the tax disappear. So we want to be able to do that corporate redemption, which is an entity type agreement, but oftentimes we want to preserve the right to get the other tax benefits by doing the rest of the purchase on a cross-purchase basis. So that's what a hybrid agreement does. It takes the best of both worlds and puts them together. Now, the entity agreement is just with the business. These are sometimes referred to as redemption agreements in the corporate setting, because corporations redeem shares. That's a tax term. But entity or redemption agreement or entity buy-sell, all the same thing. Now, the advantages. Entity controls the funding of the payment under the agreement. Now, the funding is important because if we're going to fund these things with insurance, we got to make sure those insurance premiums get paid, right? If all of you are my partners and we have a cross-purchase buy-sell agreement, every one of us is going to have a life insurance policy on every one of us except ourselves. So we all have to have a policy on everybody else in the room, and that means we have to pay the premiums on those policies and make sure that we're not subjecting them to creditor claims and so on. And if I don't pay the premiums on the life insurance policy, you drop dead. Your estate's looking for me to buy you out, or at least buy out my portion of I don't have the cash to do it. We kind of messed up the agreement, haven't we? So with a cross-purchase agreement, you're running a little bit of a risk because you have multiple parties in the funding side of the house. With an entity agreement, the corporation takes care of everything. So you buy one policy on everyone's life, and the corporation or the entity, whatever it is, well, it doesn't have to be a corporation, but the entity will pay the premiums on that and receive the proceeds. So it makes it a little bit easier. Minimal involvement is necessary for the same reason. But the life death benefits are generally not taxable. They are usually not subject to tax. However, if you have a corporation and the corporation is, it depends on the size of the death benefit relative to the earnings of the corporation, but there's a complex adjustment that has to be made called the ACE adjustment that could subject the death benefit on a life insurance policy owned by a corporation to tax. So we have a potential issue there that we have to deal with. Something that we haven't had to deal with for the last 11 years, and we won't have to deal with next year, but it'll rear its ugly head again in 2013, is the accumulated earnings tax. It's possible that we could have an accumulated earnings tax issue as well, and if we do that, then we might want to have life insurance death benefits higher than the full value of the buyout. So we'll talk more about that when we get to some of the specifics. It requires fewer life insurance funding. I just described that. Now, the disadvantages. Premiums are not deductible. Life insurance premiums are never deductible unless they're inside of a qualified plan. That's the only way to get a deduction, really, if it's used for retirement purposes. And that's okay. We don't care about that because we get the tax-free death benefit. I'd rather pay tax on the premium than pay tax on the death benefit any day. So that's going to give me a better benefit, right? Cash value adds to the accumulated earnings. You haven't heard about that. I bet you, even in your tax classes, you haven't talked about this. Because in 2001, this issue went away because we have a special rule with qualified dividends, and everybody switched the way they were doing things inside corporations so that this didn't become an issue. But now, when 2013 comes around, this accumulated earnings tax could again become an issue, because a lot of companies will probably tighten up their dividend paying policies. And if a corporation has more than $250,000 in retained earnings and can't justify that by the reasonable needs of the business, there's a third tax the corporation has to pay called the accumulated earnings tax, and it's a flat 35% of the excess earnings. So now not only does the corporation pay tax on its income, the shareholders pay tax on the dividends, but now we pay this accumulated earnings tax as well. That's going to become an issue again when we lose the qualified dividend status. So you have to have a way of justifying the earnings. And there are some buy-sell applications to this, which if we have time, I'll mention all of these. Family attribution rules may apply to corporate agreements. If you have a family-held business, a red flag should be going up the pole. Anytime you have a family-held business, we're going to have all kinds of complications because we have family attribution rules that apply to the tax attributes that are not that easy to deal with. They're not that easy to get around. And these attribution rules essentially say that if you own shares and I own shares, well, let's say my wife owns shares and my kids own shares in the company and my parents own shares in the company, and all together we own 100% of the company, guess who's deemed to own 100% of the company? I am. Because I'm deemed to own all the shares that my parents own, my kids own, my wife owns. So these family attribution rules can make it impossible to engage in certain types of planning unless we can waive the attribution rules. I'll show you how to do that in a second. Or we can somehow tiptoe around them. So life insurance death benefit can increase the value of the entity. That's always an issue, particularly for smaller companies. If you have a buy-sell agreement and you have cash value life insurance policies inside the company, that's an asset of the company. And arguably, as you receive that money, the cash value grows, and as you receive the death benefits, that's going to increase the value of the corporate assets. So that means we're increasing the value of the business just by virtue of the fact that we have a buy-sell agreement in place. Now, sometimes we can argue around this. It depends on the It depends on the nature of the relationship between the owner and the business. If the person that dies and is being bought out was a key employee of the company, was a person who was providing extraordinary services to the company that were very valuable, you could argue that the loss of that person and their skill set to the company was just offset by the life insurance proceeds received. So if we have that kind of a relationship between the two, maybe we don't have an increase in the corporate value. But if we have one of these family-owned businesses that has 50 different family members who are owners, and only five of them are really running the business, taking part in the business, and you have these non-active owners, and the entity agreement is in place, you may be artificially propping up the size of the entity for all of the owners, which can complicate the planning. So just something to think about. And then also, state law could prohibit you from following through on the buy-sell agreement if you're not solvent at the time you want to enter into the purchase. Under corporate law, corporations are usually prohibited from distributing more than their surplus. So if you, let's say that I die and the company receives a life insurance policy, but we didn't keep things up to date, so it's not enough to cover the buyout, and even taking into consideration the surplus capital in the company, there's not enough to cover the buyout, state law may prohibit that transaction from being engaged in. Now the problem with this is this really thwarts the planning of the individuals, doesn't it? The person that was expecting the buyout is going to now not have the liquidity in their estate, isn't going to be able to turn that interest into cash, and we're going to have some mega problems on the personal side. And if the corporation doesn't have the adequate surplus to do this, then we may already have problems on the corporate side. So we have a lot of things to deal with in that type of arrangement. Now the cross purchase, this is where all of the owners buy each other out. And usually they buy each other out in proportion to their ownership interest. So that's the example where all of us are partners and we all agree to buy each other out. When I die, each of you will buy a percentage of my shares equal to your percentage ownership in the company. That's how it'll work. That's why each of you will have to have a life insurance policy on my life. Or you'll have to outright fund it if you can, but usually this is done by life insurance. Now the advantage here is that you get the death benefit on the life insurance tax-free. And when you purchase the interest from me, what does that do to your basis in the entity? It goes up. You own a bigger percentage in the entity, but because you used your tax-free money, your after-tax money or your capital to buy my interest out, you've just increased your basis in the business entity by that amount. And by doing that, when you go to sell, what have you done? You've reduced the gain, right? You've reduced the amount that you have to pay future capital gains tax on because of the increase in the basis. You can't do that with an entity type buy-sell. You can only do that with a cross-purchase buy-sell. With the entity type buy-sell, when the entity buys the interest from the owner's estate, it brings that equity interest into the company, and everybody else owns more, but has everybody else put more capital into their position in the company? No, they haven't. So they have a bigger percentage ownership, but the same basis they had before. So if they decided to sell out right away, there'd be a bigger taxable gain compared to an agreement that was set up on a cross-purchase basis. So that's one of the consequences of entity buy-sells. Surviving owners receive the increase, I just mentioned that. Life insurance removed from the claims of the corporate creditors. Now there's a trade-off here, because if you have life insurance held at the corporate level, the corporate creditors can get a hold of that, and that could potentially thwart the agreement, right? If you have life insurance held by all the owners, any one of our creditors might be able to get access to that policy, and that could thwart the agreement. Now, different states have different rules on this, and actually in the asset protection piece, I'll give you a chart that shows you the asset protection aspects of all the various financial products by state, and you can see what it looks like. I assume most of you are from Texas, but maybe a few people like me who are from outside, you never know, but I think in Texas, life insurance is completely protected from the claims of creditors. You go to a place like Pennsylvania, it's not. So if we were conducting business in Pennsylvania, or I was a Pennsylvania citizen, and I have life insurance policies on all your lives, and I get into trouble because I can't manage my money. I used to work in Congress before I moved over to the business side of the house, and I can't manage my money, and I go bankrupt. The bankruptcy trustee can take all those policies, drain all the cash out of them, and use those to pay my debts. And now if any of you die, you're at risk of not being able to get the buyout because I don't have any money now to buy you out. So we have an issue there. Now we can fix this issue as well as the number of policies that we need, the potential number of policies we need, by using something called a trusted cross-purchase. A trusted cross-purchase agreement is where we set up a trust to hold all the policies on the lives of the individuals. And then the trust, since the trust is a separate entity from the individuals, it's shielded from the claims of the individual's creditors. So there's always a way around it. You just have to structure it a particular way. And then when we have a cross-purchase buy-sell, we don't care what the solvency or surplus status of a corporation is. It doesn't matter. Even if the corporation's insolvent, you still have a legal obligation under the buy-sell to effectuate the buy-sell agreement, which will provide the liquidity for the estate, and everything will work. So we don't have those types of restraints here that we would with the entity buy-sell. Now the disadvantages, we have lots of life insurance policies that have to be purchased. The agent will probably be thrilled if all of us are partners and we want to set up a cross-purchase buy-sell, until he finds out how many applications he's going to have to sit down and write out. Right? There's an awful lot of, each one of us needs a policy on everyone else's life. So you need n times n minus 1. That's the number of policies that you need. N times n minus 1, where n is the number of partners. A lot of policies. Owners are responsible for the funding. So that means I have to trust all of you to make the premium payments, so that when I die, you have the money to pay me or pay my estate off. If you don't make the payments, that could place the whole agreement in jeopardy. And then we do have the creditor issue. I mentioned that. Now, the hybrid agreement is a combination of the two. And this is usually combined with a Section 303 redemption with a corporation. So this is only going to apply when we're looking at C corporations and we're trying to effectuate a corporate redemption at death. But what we do is we have a first option in this agreement where there's an entity buy-sell agreement. The company has the right to buy the shares of the owner. Now, what the company will do in this scenario is it'll exercise that option to the extent of the owner's taxes and administration expenses in the estate, because that's the amount we can effectuate a 303 redemption for. I'll show you this in just a second. But we're going to exercise the option for the amount of the estate taxes and administration expenses in the deceased owner's estate. And then the surviving owners have the option of buying the rest of the shares. So then we move to a cross-purchase agreement. Why do we want the surviving owners to have that option? Because we want that basis step up. We want to make sure that the surviving owners get an increase in their basis in the entity so that if they later sell that entity, there's less of a taxable gain. Now, if this is a real family business, do we care? Probably not, because the family business is going to go through the family, right? And we don't care what basis is. If it's going to consistently stay in the family and they're not going to sell it, basis doesn't matter. But barring that, if there's a possibility of sale, that could become an issue. And then if the surviving owners don't buy the rest of the shares just to protect the estate of the deceased owner, we make the corporation buy the remaining shares. So the last one isn't an option. That's a requirement for the entity to buy the shares. And the purpose is just to get that tax agreement. Now, community property states, since we're in Texas, this is important. If you have a community property state, property acquired during marriage is community property. So we need to have spousal consent to these agreements. Even if your husband or wife does not own the interest in the entity, they should be parties to the agreement, requiring them to sell or buy the interest as appropriate. If you don't have the spouses as parties to these agreements and a divorce occurs, you can have some really nasty results. Things can get really messy. So whenever there's a community property, and even in common law states, I come from a common law state, I routinely, in a buy-sell agreement, require the spouses to sign as parties to the agreement, because I don't want any spouse saying that they didn't know what was going on and that they somehow object to the arrangement and try and thwart the arrangement. If they all sign it, they're all obligated to it, and then we don't have to worry about the consequences at the tail end. So it's always a good idea to do this, even if you're not in a non-community property state. Now, when we set these up, we want to make sure the documents of the entity allow the transfer restrictions. Sometimes states put limitations on this. It depends on the type of entity and the purpose of the entity. But that's a function of state law, so the attorney should take care of that. You want to determine if the creditors have access to the policies that are going to be funding this so that you know whether or not we need to take further action to protect that from the claims of creditors. And then you also want to put restrictions on the ownership certificates. And this is something that most people don't do, but if you don't do this, you're probably not going to have an effective agreement. You have to take back all of the shares that were issued in that company, and you have to type a legend on the shares saying that these shares are subject to transfer restrictions, more specifically specified in an agreement dated July 23rd, 2011, between the owners of the company. And unless you put that on the face of the stock certificates, if one of the owners goes out and sells that stock at a later time, that person, that subsequent purchaser, who didn't have knowledge of the buy-sell agreement, may not be subject to the terms of the buy-sell agreement. So we have to have those restrictions placed on the certificate. People forget about it all the time, so I don't want to do that. Okay, some special problems with a corporate buy-sell. Now, corporations are kind of nasty creatures from a tax standpoint because they have this double tax feature, right? We have this distribution that is taxed twice. You get taxed when you earn the money, and then you distribute the money, and it gets taxed again as a dividend. And that double tax feature also has some ripple effects when we talk about the buy-sell agreements. So we're going to talk about two sections primarily of the code here, sections 302 and 303, which directly apply to the buy-sell planning that you'll do. Now, what section 302 says is that if there's a distribution from a corporation to a shareholder, that distribution is treated as a dividend unless an exception applies. So it mandates dividend tax treatment unless you meet very specific exceptions to get out. Now, if it mandates dividend tax treatment, what does that mean for the person that receives the payment? They got to pay tax on that dividend. Now, it's not so bad right now because we have a qualified dividend tax rate, 15% dividend tax rate. But beginning in 2013, when the dividend tax rate goes up to 42.6%, that's going to be a big issue for a lot of people if we mandate dividend tax treatment. Now, if we set up an entity type buy-sell agreement, all of us are partners, we set up the entity agreement where the company agrees to buy the shares from me when I die, even though we have an agreement for the purchase and sale of the stock, Section 302 says when a company distributes anything to an owner, my estate would be the owner, my successor owner, that's a dividend. And the estate's going to have to pay tax on that unless we meet the exceptions. So, the question becomes, what are the exceptions? Well, there are four basic exceptions. You can have a redemption that's not essentially equivalent to a dividend. Now think about that language. It's not essentially equivalent to a dividend. Can anybody tell me what that means?
Well, if you have a full redemption of the stock.
Well, full redemption is another exception. Well, what about it? What is not essentially equivalent to a dividend mean?
Well, it couldn't be uniform among all the shareholders.
Well, that actually, if it's uniform among all the shareholders, I'd argue that that's more like a dividend.
Yeah, that would be. So it can't be that.
Right. Bottom line is there's no bright line test here. When we use a test like not essentially equivalent to a dividend, you have to wear a black robe and sit on a dais to be able to figure that out. You have to be a judge deciding the case. And until you are deciding that case as the judge, you don't really know what it means. So we can't rely on that for tax purposes. We never want to use that provision as an exception out of this dividend tax treatment rule. Now, you mentioned complete redemption. Sure, if we completely redeem all the shares, then we'll get capital gains tax treatment, which is what we want. We want the capital gains tax treatment. We don't want the treatment as a dividend. It's not a big deal now, but 2013 will be a really big deal. Complete redemption means you sell all of your shares back to the company. So if I die and my estate sells all of its shares back to the company, that sounds like a complete redemption, right? Mm-hmm. But if it's a family firm, is it a complete redemption? No. It's not a complete redemption because we're going to have something called the family attribution rules applying to this transfer. And if I'll talk about that in a second, but basically if my wife owns shares, my parents own shares, my kids or grandkids own shares, all of those shares are attributed to me. So even if my estate sells all of the shares it has back to the company, I'm still deemed to own shares, so I can't have completely redeemed my shares. Because all of those shares owned by the other people are attributed to me. So that prevents me from doing a complete redemption when you have a family-owned business. Now there's one major way out of this, and I'm going to describe this in a second. We can waive the family attribution rules in certain cases. And there are requirements for that. I'll cover that in a second. So that's a possibility. But whenever you see a family-held business, you should always be concerned about this potential for complete redemption, because we're going to have to take additional steps to avoid dividend tax treatment. Now, substantially disproportionate redemption is actually a three-part test. It's a mathematical test. So if you meet the mathematical test, you win. If you don't, you lose. So the nice thing about it is it's a bright line test. The bad thing about it is it's complex to apply. And so we're not going to go through the application of it. I'm just going to talk about how it works in general here. And then the last one I've already mentioned is that 303 redemption. A 303 redemption is a redemption of shares at death, subject to certain limitations, subject to limitations that are contained in that section. Now, not essentially, U.S. v. Davis gave us a lot of insight into what not essentially equivalent to a dividend means. They just said it means a meaningful reduction. Well, I can't get much more out of meaningful reduction than I can out of not essentially equivalent to a dividend. So this is such a vague standard that we don't want to rely on it. That's the bottom line. Complete redemption, I already mentioned, occurs when you sell all your shares, but we have the family attribution rules. And family, for this purpose, is defined under Section 318 of the Code, which includes your parents, your spouse, your children, and your grandchildren. It does not include your siblings, your nieces and nephews, your grandparents. So we're going up one, down two, and since the spouse is the same as you are from a tax standpoint, right? Husband and wife are a unit for tax purposes. We include the spouse as well. So that means any shares that any of those people own are attributed to me, and I can't do a complete redemption. Everybody see that? So if my kid, let's say I own 50% of the company, my kid owns 50% of the company, I die, my estate redeems all the shares to the corporation, that's not a complete redemption because I'm deemed to own the shares that my child owns for tax purposes. See the problem? All right, now how do we get out of that? We can waive the family attribution rules. And these are the requirements for waiver of family attribution rules. First of all, you have to have no interest in the corporation at all once you sell your shares back, except as a creditor. Why do you think they let you have creditor status? Right, because a lot of times people don't do the funding that they're supposed to do for these agreements, and the only way to effectuate the redemption would be for the corporation to agree to buy out over a period of time. So they buy the shares and they agree to pay it out in an installment note fashion, right? So you can have a creditor status, but you can't be an officer, you can't be a director, you can't in any way have any say over what goes on in that company. You have to be completely out in order to waive the family attribution rules. Second one, you can't acquire an interest in that business within 10 years. So I can't have some kind of phony arrangement set up where I redeem all of my shares, but then 2 weeks later, my brother gives me more shares in the company. That's not really a complete redemption. A complete redemption implies that you're getting out. And if I do something like that, that was just a convoluted way to transform what should have been a dividend distribution into a capital gains distribution to save tax. So they're not going to let me do it. You have to be out for 10 years. That's a long period of time, especially in a family business. So it has to be something substantial. Now, if somebody dies and leaves you shares, that's okay. So if you do a complete redemption of shares, while you're alive because you want out, and then grandpa dies and he leaves shares to you, that's all right because you have no control over that. But if somebody gives you shares in any way other than through an inheritance, we've got a problem. You have to file an agreement with the IRS. I love this part. You have to agree with the IRS to inform them if you ever acquire shares in the company. Now, what does that do? You're filing this agreement to tell the IRS that if you ever acquire shares in the next 10 years, you're basically going to rat yourself out. What's the effect of that from a legal standpoint?
Self-incrimination.
Okay, well, it's not a criminal issue.
It takes it automatically to fraud.
So, it automatically makes it fraud. If you violate the agreement, you've committed fraud, and that keeps that statute of limitations open forever. So I guess it wouldn't start out as a criminal matter, so we can't argue self-incrimination. It could end up as a criminal matter if there's a big enough money amount at stake. So, but good thought.
So does everyone in the family need to have a waiver then?
Well, no, the person getting out has to waive.
Okay.
So whoever's selling and wants to get out has to meet all of these requirements.
So what happens if, as a family, you own it, and you and your father used to own it, and you kind of, and mother and child and all that kind of stuff, the father, who's basically running his whole life, you just hire him on as a shop foreman, and he runs the entire business and they can sell it. But no shares.
No, but he was it within 10 years of him redeeming his shares? No.
They can't be an employee.
Nope.
Employee,
owner, you can't have any interest in the company at all. Consultant, you can't even be a consultant.
Now this applies if it's a living person who redeems shares.
Well, it could apply in the estate as well. Okay. Because the estate, there are other attribution rules that could apply. The estate will have the other attribution rules. It's almost impossible to have an estate do it, you're right. It's almost impossible to make that work. But for an estate to have a waiver, because we also, in addition to the family attribution rules, there are trust attribution rules, corporate attribution rules, beneficiary attribution rules. All of these things come into play, and you can't waive any of those other attribution rules. You can only waive the family attribution rules. So if for some reason the estate would be attributed shares from some other entity or person, that's enough to prevent a complete redemption from occurring. And then you're stuck with dividend tax treatment.
So in an estate situation, you don't want an empty repurchase agreement if you've got family attribution, right? You want a cross purchase?
Right, that's right. If we have a cross purchase agreement, do we have to worry about any of this? No, because the corporation is not purchasing the shares. We don't have to worry about any of this at all. So cross purchase would be better from that standpoint. That's right. Okay, so file the agreement, and then we have a 10-year look back. If you redeem stock within that 10-year period, then that poses a problem. So if you meet those four requirements, you can waive the family attribution rules, and that means you can effectuate a complete redemption and get dividend tax treatment. Now, even in today's environment, where the dividend tax is 15% and the capital gains tax is 15%, why am I still concerned with this rule? If I don't meet the requirements for a complete redemption and it's treated as a dividend, what does that do to me? What does that subject to tax? And on the flip side, if I get to treat it as a capital transaction, because I waive the family attribution rules and I've effectuated complete redemption, how is that one going to be taxed? They're both taxed at 15%, but there's a big difference in the way they're treated. What's the difference?
For tax purposes?
Yep. If it's a dividend, do I get to take advantage of any of my basis in the entity?
No.
Every dime I get is taxed at 15%. If it's treated as a complete redemption and I get capital gains tax treatment, I only have to pay tax on the difference between what I get and my basis in the company. So even now, when the taxes are the same, the 15% qualified dividend rate and the 15% capital gains rate is the same, The only way to take advantage of the basis that I have in that entity is to meet one of these exceptions, and the one example will be the complete redemption. Make sense? Kind of? Okay. So that's that's the family attribution. Now these are the other ones: estate, trust, corporate, and partnership attribution. We're not going to go through this in detail, but basically this is how it works. If any of these entities has an interest in the company, and you are a beneficiary or an owner of any of these entities, guess what? The entity's ownership percentage is attributed to you based on your ownership percentage in that entity. So let's say you an estate, or let's say a trust, owns 100 shares of stock in this company, and you're a 50% beneficiary of the trust. Your present right is 50% of the value of the trust. 50 of the shares owned by that trust will be attributed to you. Same thing with an estate, with a corporation. We do it based on ownership in the corporation. Same thing with a partnership. Now this is even trickier, because when you have these things applying, you can't waive them. So you got to be real careful when you're doing family business succession planning and you're using trust vehicles. You got to be real careful about how you position those shares in the company. Because if you position shares in trust, trusts are good things to use from an estate planning standpoint, but I could be blowing my right to get a complete redemption on shares at death, if that's what I'm looking for, if I inartfully position those assets in the wrong places. Everybody see what I'm getting at? I don't want to go through all the examples, we're running out of time, but I just want to raise the awareness. If you know that the red flag should run up in circumstances like this, so you go look for it, or you go to your accountant, you go to your lawyer, and you ask them about it, that's what you need to know as the planner. You don't need to know all the detail of the law. That's what the CPAs and the lawyers are there to help you with. Okay, now substantially disproportionate redemption is another exception to the dividend tax treatment. So we have not essentially equivalent to a dividend, complete redemption, which we just went over, and substantially disproportionate redemption. This is a mathematical test. And what we have to do is we have to look at your ownership interest before and after the redemption. So immediately after the redemption, you have to own less than 50% of the voting class stock. So what does that mean? You can't have control. If you're going to do this, you can't have control of the entity. You've got to shift that control to someone else, or maybe you didn't have control to begin with, but you have to own less than 50% of the voting stock you had, plus you have to own less than 80% of the voting stock you owned prior to the redemption, plus you have to own less than 80% of the common stock owned prior to the redemption. Now, in a lot of cases, these things will merge, because there might only be one class of stock, but if there are multiple classes of stock, this can get a little bit more interesting. So it's a mathematical test. It'd take 40 minutes probably to go through a couple of examples and show you how this works. We don't have that time. But if you really want a few examples, let me know and I'll get you a reading on it that you can go through. I have a couple of articles that I can provide for you. Now, the one I want to get to, and this is probably where we'll end, is this redemption at death. Because this ties into some of the estate planning tools. Now, remember when we were talking about estate tax, I mentioned when we did the calculation, we start out with the gross estate, and then we calculate something called the adjusted gross estate, then we get down to the taxable estate, so it's like the income tax calculation. The only thing the adjusted gross estate matters for are business owners. Because only business owners can take advantage of 303 redemptions, 6166 deferrals of estate tax, special use valuation, and the qualified family-owned business exclusion. And that last one is almost a nonsense issue, although it's been revived for a short period of time. It's a nonsense issue for all practical purposes. This one's a big one, Section 303 redemptions. It will only apply if you have a C corporation at death where we're trying to redeem shares from the C corp. So we're trying to do an entity type agreement between the corporation and the owner. Now, why is this important? Well, why would we want to do this to begin with? We already know cross-purchase, usually for tax purposes, gives us a better result. Well, what happens with a corporation is we have this little account called retained earnings. And every year, we take the difference between what we earn in the company and what we've paid out in dividends, and we add it to retained earnings. So hopefully it's an addition, right? If we have losses, I guess that's a subtraction. But hopefully we have all these additions to retain earnings. And the problem with retained earnings is that that's tainted money inside the corporation. Because any time this comes out and goes to a shareholder, what's that treated as? A dividend. It's treated as a dividend distribution. Now, one way to get out of this tax treatment is to do a 303 redemption. With a 303 redemption, we have the entity purchasing the shares from the estate of the deceased shareholder, or whoever owns the shares. It has to be the person who's obligated to pay the estate tax. But and we can only redeem enough of the shares so that we can cover the estate taxes, administration expenses, and funeral expenses. So we add those up from the estate. We figure out how much that is. We figure out how many shares we have to sell back to the company, and that's what we redeem. Now, the magic to this is when we do that redemption, that draws down the retained earnings, the earnings and profits, technically, of the corporation, but it's treated as a capital transaction. What's your basis in those shares, or what's the estate's basis in those shares when the redemption occurs? I die today. Tomorrow, my estate redeems shares, or the corporation redeems shares from my estate. What's the estate's basis in those shares? It's been stepped up to fair market value at date of death, right? And since we're treating this as a capital transaction and we have a stepped up basis, the fair market value is 100, the basis is 100, and how much tax do I pay on the gain?
Zero.
But even though that's treated as a capital transaction, that still draws down the earnings and profits of the corporation. So that's a way of picking out tainted money from the corporation and avoiding the income tax. This is a beautiful thing. This avoids double taxation in a C corporation. The company paid tax on the money when it earned it, but then if we do a 303 redemption at death, we don't have to pay the income tax on that amount that we take out. Everybody see that? This is a really significant issue. This is why we do the hybrid agreements. Whenever you have a corporation, a C corporation that has lots of retained earnings in it, that's a planning nightmare because of the tax consequences of having all those retained earnings. So if we do have buy-sells in place, we want to draw down those retained earnings by using these redemptions. That's okay. That's the bottom line.
But on the 303, we still have issues if we've got family attribution, right?
Well, yes, but if you limit it to this, you don't have a problem. If you go over the estate taxes, administration expenses, and funeral expenses, then you're back to that regime under 302, okay, where you have to worry about the family attribution
rules.
So
the amount that's paid for the redemption is only equal to those three.
Right.
Then we can do a 303.
Exactly.
And we don't have to worry about.
You don't have to worry about the family attribution rules. This is a special provision in the code that gets you out of all that other nonsense that we just talked about. So 303 is a neat, neat tool for anybody that has a C corporation, or for that matter, an S corporation that has prior taxed earnings inside in its capital account. When it was a C corporation that later turned to an S, you could try and allocate those to the prior taxed earnings, or you could make sure that you distribute all of the, I think the way you'd have to do it is distribute all of the S corp earnings before death, but then once the death occurs, we could then drain the prior taxed earnings from the C corporation.
Now, it's saying that it must amount to 35% a year
to right.
Gross estate.
Yes.
Is that per corporation, or
no,
is that for all corporations there?
Well, you can aggregate businesses.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah, you can aggregate businesses. You have to have at least one business that represents 20% of your adjusted gross estate, and then all the rest can add up to 35. Now, this is why the retained interest rules in estate planning can hurt business owners. Because let's say we set up a charitable remainder trust, for example. We already know, we talked about this before, we set up a CRT where I receive the income interest for life. I'm the owner, I receive the income interest. I also have a business interest. My gross estate is going to include the full value of the CRT, right? which means my adjusted gross estate is going to include the full value of the CRT because the charitable deduction doesn't come in until after we calculate the adjusted gross estate. So the CRT value comes in here and it goes out here, so it's not in the taxable estate, but whenever I have a retained interest provision like this that would be included in the estate, what does that do to the percentage of the business in my adjusted gross estate? It actually lowers it, right? Because if I had $1 million, let's just say it's $1 million, and then I had another $1 million from the CRT, now I have a $2 million estate, but the business is fixed. The business value is fixed. So it lowers the value of the business in the adjusted gross estate, which makes it less likely we're going to be able to qualify for this provision. The reason I'm pointing this out is this requires planning. This requires additional advanced planning. You can't just say, oh, well, you've got a corporation. When you kick the bucket, we'll take care of this with a 303 redemption, and everybody will be happy. We've got to make sure we manage the size of this estate so that we have at least 35% of the adjusted gross estate tied up in the business interests or in a combination of business interests to qualify for that provision. Everybody see this? Question?
Can you ever use retained earnings in a situation like that? Kind of like you were talking about some of those trusts where you buy your house or things like that, or is that against the rules of the corporation?
Well, have the corporation buy your house?
Can your corporation own assets that are for your use?
Yes, they can, and if you look at most of these smaller, closely held corporations that and they want to sell the company, what's one of the first things we have to do, accountants?
We have to separate
all the personal assets out from the business assets, right? Because they have vacation homes and they have all kinds of stuff on the corporate books that really aren't corporate assets. They shouldn't be there to begin with. That's right. But they put them there, and they think they're doing a good thing because they're getting some kind of protection or something on it. But it really complicates matters when you try and sell the business or transfer the business, because that can confuse the value. It could affect the valuation too. So that can be an issue. But you see, yeah, you can. The better way to do it, though, would be to take it out and then deploy it elsewhere. But if you have a C corporation, the problem with taking it out is you pay the dividend tax. Yeah. Now you can adjust the percentages by doing things, very simple things. Like, for instance, let's say that I'm charitably inclined and I was going to leave a bunch of money to charity when I died. I had this intent to benefit this particular charity and I'm going to leave a big chunk of money to them. Well, if I wait till I die, it's in my gross estate, isn't it?
Yes.
If I donate it 5 minutes before I die, is it included in my gross estate?
No.
So by lowering the size of the gross estate, what am I doing? I'm increasing the percentage that the business represents in my gross estate. So you can do some simple things like give away charitable gifts. You can give away annual exclusion gifts right before you die. You can pay for kids and grandkids' education right before you die. That manipulates the top number and makes it more likely you're going to qualify for the 303 redemption. Does this make sense? Have you covered this in other classes, this technique? You have? Miss Ellie?
No, the, like reducing your state? What?
Well, I mean the 303 issues.
Oh, no.
No? You haven't seen this before?
I don't think we talked about it, Miss Ellie.
No?
In Ricketts' class.
Well, it might not, right, it might not be a big topic in income tax right now because it's not, it doesn't, there's no margin, well, there is still a bit, yeah, it's not as significant with the lower tax rate. So maybe that's why they don't cover it, but.
Corporate income tax, they do.
Just a little?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, in corporate income tax, you're doing mergers and acquisitions and spin-offs and all that stuff, right? You're not worrying about this nonsense. But do you all have a gist of how this works? What I'm more concerned about is not that you have super level of technical knowledge, but that you have an understanding of where there could be potential problems so you can bring in help when you need it. That's the important part. You bring the accountant in, you bring the lawyer in to help you out when this gets a little more expensive. So anyway, that's the corporate redemption of death. We avoid the capital gains tax because of the step up and reduce the corporate earnings and profits. The remaining portion is taxed as a dividend. if 302 doesn't give us an exception. So if you do a complete redemption from the estate, remember 303 only applies to estate taxes, administration expenses, and funeral expenses. It will not apply to the excess. So then we go back to the 302 rule, which treats the rest as a dividend unless we meet one of those exceptions, which means it's not essentially equivalent to a dividend, it's a complete redemption, or it's a substantially disproportionate redemption. So that's how that tax structure would work. Family attribution rules don't apply here, and we can't waive the other attribution rules. Okay. Let me get him, and then I'll get you, and then.
If it is a buy-sell agreement, though, that we're talking about here, why wouldn't you do a complete redemption? Aren't you trying to sell your entire interest?
Right, but for tax purposes, your entire interest may not be a complete redemption.
Oh, because of that.
Because of the family attribution rules, right?
But there's no other reason why except for those attribution rules, right?
Well, the attribution rules are there to prevent abuse, and to prevent family members from engaging in transactions to move tax consequences around the family.
Yeah.
That's really what they were there for. But it provides a practical hurdle for us to jump over on the estate tax side when we're trying to effectuate the buyout. So you do have a legal obligation once you execute a buy-sell agreement, both parties are legally obligated to buy and sell. There's no problem there. You have the legal obligation. But what we're talking about here are the tax consequences of that sale. And in order to make the legal obligation work in a way that's efficient, you have to design it so that those tax consequences are mitigated in the agreement. This is why buy-sell agreements are not, if you go to that lawyer, that kind of the country lawyer that does the divorces and the real estate closings and wills and trusts and does all this stuff, and he may not be up to date on all of this tax stuff. If he takes a form out of a book and doesn't understand the tax consequences of the language in that form, it's really easy to mess this up. So this is another one of those areas where you want to go to somebody that does this stuff a lot. You don't want to go to somebody that does this once every 5 years and has a form that they use and copy and white out the name and put a new name in. That's not going to work in this kind of circumstance. Okay, you had a question.
Since you're only paying the dividend of payment to one individual, would it qualify under Section 302 to not be considered dividend because it's materially not a dividend then? Or would it still not?
And it's still not, unless you meet one of those three exceptions.
That's one of the exceptions, in a sense.
Well, it's not essentially equivalent to a dividend, right?
Yeah, and since you're paying to one, it's not a dividend, or is that not really argued?
Well, remember, the purpose of the rule is to prevent the taxpayer from getting away from the tax result. So the courts are going to interpret that very strictly. And I don't know of any cases where they've said it's not essentially equivalent to a dividend, aside from giving us this vague language that there has to be a material difference. Basically, it's a smell test.
Yeah.
If the court smells it and it smells okay, they're going to say, all right, it's substantially equivalent to a dividend. If they don't think it smells okay, then they're going to say dividend tax treatment. And the problem is, from judge to judge, that standard's going to be a little bit different, because what one judge perceives as legitimate, another judge may perceive as pushing the line. So if you want to get certainty, and remember, what one of the things we want to do on a planning side is we want to take as much discretion as we can away from judges and courts. We want to decide what's going to happen. So I'd rather use the complete redemption, substantially disproportionate redemption rules, and make sure I have a bright line, met the bright line test, so no judge can tell me that I don't get that treatment, then roll the dice and hope that I get the right treatment. See, that's. But if you have a client that's risk-seeking, it's a little more risk-tolerant. It may be appropriate. So the risk tolerance comes into this as well. We always talk about risk tolerance in an investment context, and there's certainly risk in the investment context because you can lose money. But there's also risk here when you're talking about different techniques that could potentially have different outcomes. So a more risk-seeking client may be just fine with rolling the dice, where if you have that conservative client, you probably don't want to go anywhere near there, or when the bad result occurs, you're going to get sued. Follow up? No?
I didn't realize until the day that you said that it's buy-sell puts an obligation on you. I always thought it was an option. So if you see something bad coming down the road, if there's a big lawsuit or like environmental liability you're talking to, what do you do? I mean, if you're forced into that, is there any way to avoid having to go through your buy-sell obligation?
Well, yeah. Now, in a lot of buy-sells, they create option contracts in the buy-sell. So, for example, they might have a tiered approach, where somebody has the option to buy, then somebody else has the option to buy, and then ultimately somebody has an obligation to buy. But unless there's an obligation being created, you don't really have an effective agreement.
Is that like the first right of refusal
contract? Yeah, first right of refusal is an option contract. From a legal standpoint, it's the same thing as an option contract. So you might see that. And a lot of times in buy sells that are triggered on events other than death or disability, you'll see those set up as options. So if one of the business owners gets divorced, one of the worst things that could happen would be to have an outlaw come in and take over their function or try and exert control over their ownership interest in the business. So that may give an option to the remaining owners to buy out, to force the divorced spouse to sell any shares that he or she has back to the company or back to the other owners. So in that sense, it's an option, but it still creates an obligation on one party's part. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And it can get a little confusing when you read the language sometimes, because especially with the legalese that goes into it. But in concept, it's simple. We want to create the obligation so that we have the funding available so that we can effectuate the transfer and avoid the problems that we talked about earlier.
You always have to have the business valued for a buy sell, or can you just agree to it?
Well, I would always want to have it valued. If you don't have it valued, you're running another risk, which we're going to talk about tomorrow when we talk about that Section 2703 rule, which imposes valuation standards on the buy-sell agreement. And those valuation standards are pretty strict. So most of the time, you have to not only value it when you enter into the buy-sell, but you're going to have to update that value over time and make sure that the funding is appropriate over time. So this isn't the kind of thing you can write, put on the shelf, and forget about for 25 years until someone dies. You need to revisit that multiple times between the execution and the death date. Yep. Yeah, it can get expensive. Business valuation.
Yeah. I charge $3,500 flat, and then add it on.
After that. Yeah, it's not cheap to get the valuation, but sometimes too with the valuation, particularly for a buy sell, you could get a valuation that includes a formula clause, so that for the next 5 or 6 years, that formula could be used to evaluate or set the price of the business. That'd be legally binding, and it'd be recognized by the IRS. As long as it was determined by a person qualified to do that. You can't just, it has to be somebody that is used to valuing businesses, and if I regularly determine the value of fine art, I'm not qualified to determine the value of a business interest. And even within businesses, you might have expertise in certain areas. So the relative competence of the appraiser will be determined by their background. Okay, other questions?
So in a family-owned business, mm-hmm. where attribution is typically a problem.
Yep.
And the limitation of the 303 redemption might not really meet their needs for the value of the business.
Mm-hmm.
Is it best just to have a cross-purchase? As opposed to an entity purchase?
Yes. I would default to cross-purchase and then move to entity purchase only if there's a compelling reason to do so. One of those reasons might be lots of excess retained earnings in that company. So we want to strip those retained earnings out. So that might be a reason. But I would always start with the cross-purchase. Personally, that's my guess. Other people would say differently, I'm sure, but that'd be my preference. Questions? No. All right, we've about hit our time, so let's come back. Well, when we come back tomorrow, we'll continue with this. I'll show you some practical applications of this and some structures you can use to change the outcome of the traditional buy-sell agreement.
For those of you